Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Wonders of the Night Sky, You Must See Before You Die, by Bob King, also known as Astro Bob. And I've just finished this awful writing up of the start of this research paper, and the clear explanations of Astro Bob's have sort of channeled into my head. I think it's him saying, say, if you hollowed out Jupiter like a pumpkin, you could fit the other planets, and just the actual process, adding actual mechanical process to it, something that you would do, is something which is great here. So we're up to chapter 26, something called iridium flare. My fingers twitch as I write because there may be a few iridium satellites left to flare by the time you read this. The Iridium constellation of 66 telecommunication satellites plus spares was launched in the 1990s to provide worldwide wireless telephone phone service. You wouldn't think anyone other than a service subscriber would care about these orbiting birds, but satellite watchers soon discovered that the satellites' highly reflective antennas had a penchant for reflecting sunlight down to the lucky observers on the ground of a brief dazzles called flares. Iridium flares last several seconds and can appear up to 25 times as bright as the brightest planet Venus. The satellite orbits at an altitude of 777 kilometres, nearly twice as high as a space station, so they're typically faint and go unnoticed. But during a flare, the satellite quickly brightens, reaches greatest brilliance, and then fades away, all in about 20 seconds. The brightest flares cast shadows. Just remember to turn around and look instead of standing there mesmerized by the light. I usually do. Well, there you go. That is something interesting. The brightest flares are so intense that they'll practically knock you over. They also make great photos with this basic setup camera, wide angle for normal 50mm lenses, tripod, and the ability to take a time exposure of at least 15 seconds. Using the directions in the how-to section, page 105, find the time and the flare will occur on your location. 10 minutes in advance, set the camera lens to manual and camera exposure to 15 seconds or, better, 30 seconds to ISO 800. Open up the lens to its lowest f-stop, usually f28 or f4, to allow maximum amount of light. Carefully focus the camera on a bright star, then point it to where the iridium will appear. When you see the satellite begin to brighten, press the shutter button. All this assumes a few iridiums will still be in orbit by 2018 and beyond. The older iridiums are being replaced by new iridium next constellation, with completion expected in spring 2018. Iridium Next is using an entirely different antenna design that doesn't produce light bright flares. Chances are there will still be a few golden oldies around for us to enjoy for a while, but don't hesitate or you'll miss out. The amazing sky bursts will someday come to an end. Iridiums aren't the only satellites that flare. The final rocket stages that boost satellites into orbit sometimes goes along for the ride and becomes the satellite itself. Stages and some of the defunct satellites tumble occasionally produce flares, but not as predictability of the iridium. Iridiums are on schedule that they can are so on schedule that they can impress an unsuspecting family member or a friend with your predictive prowess. Tell them that you have a gut feeling something's going to happen in the sky tonight, and then step outside shortly before the flare time, look in the satellite's directions, and wait for a flare. When it happens as predicted, you'll be praised for your clairvoyant superpowers. Relish a moment and tell them the real story. Then it's how to see an iridium flare. Okay, I may as well read this because this is relevant. My favourite red site for flare predictions is Heavens Above. Log in and select your location and you're ready to start. On your home page under satellites, click on iridium flares and you'll get a list of the week's worth of flares. The time's on 24-hour clock, so whatever it is. Brightness is given on a magnitude scale, the same one astronomers use to rate star brightness. Without getting into detail, the higher the negative number, the brighter the flare. At a minimum, the flares of similar brightness to stars in the sky. But at a maximum, high as minus 9, they're super-duper bright. Altitude is given in degrees. A bald fist at arm's length gives you a span of around 10 degrees. The set of columns in the table show the direction which look the satellite's ID number, the distance and the centre of the flare, the location where it's most brilliant. Its brightness and the spot of the sun's altitude at the time of the flare. The numbers are all negative because the sun's already set. For the map showing exactly where the scare will occur, click on the time link. Let's explore the distance to the flare center concept. If you scroll to the bottom of the date time page below the sky map, you'll see a smaller map of Atlanta. That's the flare center line. Imagine it as the center of the most brilliant part of the antenna's reflection moving across the surface of the Earth. Along this line, you'll see the brightest flare possible. If the red line is near you, your location, you're in good shape. But if your house is 50 kilometers off the line, the burst will be more modest. Some satellite watchers hit the road to see the brightest flares. Well, gosh, I think I can give that a go. Now, Vesta, the brightest asteroid. Now, that would be interesting. Asteroids often make the news, especially online, where they seem intent on destroying humanity every couple of months. Robotic surveys like Pan-STARRS, University of Hawaii, and Catalina STARRS, Sky Surveys, NASA and University of Arizona, constantly monitor the skies looking for potentially hazardous satellites that could impact Earth. And every day, they discover new Earth-approaching objects, most just a few dozen feet across. Astronomers follow up on observations to determine the orbits and predict whether or not they might pose a future hazard. More than 90% of near-Earth asteroids larger than 1 kilometre have been discovered to date, and none of them are making a beeline for Earth for at least 100 years. So go ahead and order dessert. You've got time. On the other hand, we know for a fact that asteroids have struck Earth in the past with devastating results. If you've never been to Meteor Crater in Arizona, located off the 140, 37 miles east of Flagstaff, put it on your list. At 3/4 of a mile, at 1.2 kilometres across and 170 metres deep, it's not only fills your field of vision, but recalls the terror that must have ensued during its excavation some 50,000 years ago. I didn't take much to make that big hole. An iron nickel asteroid about 100 to 160 feet, 30 to 50 meters across, slammed into the ground at 12 kilometers per second, exploded with a force 150 times greater than the bomb that dropped on Hiroshima. The blast excavated 150 million tons of rock, created winds in excess of 1,000 kilometers an hour, and laid waste to mammoths, sloths, and camels that roamed the land at the time. To put it in perspective, meteoroids, which are itty bitty asteroids, pepper the Earth and land meteorites. Or burn up and become dust flakes in the atmosphere all day, every day. Larger meteoroids, like the 60-foot wide boulder that exploded in the air 30 kilometres over Klabinsk, Russia on February 2013, create shockwaves that can damage structures on the ground, cause injuries from flying gas, and drop significant meteorites. But even a rock of this size rarely survives intact. If travelling so fast that when it hits the lower atmosphere, it might as well be running into a brick wall. Most shattered pieces is exactly what happened at Klabinsk. But if pieces are large, or if the object of that size somehow survives intact, it can cause significant damage to a city. Now, one of the things is that the universe is now 2 degrees Kelvin. Now, it's bloody cold. Everything out there is absolutely shiveringly cold. So a lot of asteroids hit, they've got frost on them. NASA's current asteroid goal is to find 90% of all Earth's approaching asteroids larger than 140 metres across, the ones that would cause regional destruction and major tsunamis. Now that you have a healthy respect for asteroids, let's go out and look for one. Asteroids, big and small, make their home in the asteroid belt, a zone between Mars and Jupiter, that contains between 1.1 and 1.9 million asteroids larger than 1 kilometer, and a billion of smaller ones. Okay, now, what is it? The entire asteroid belt has a mass a tenth that of the Moon. Although the total number is large, they spread across great volumes, say, spread by an average distance of 1 million kilometers. That is greater than the Moon. So the Moon is 300,000 kilometers across. This is three times. Unlike movie depictions, they seem to swarm like honeybees. So a spacecraft passing through the belt on a mission to the outer planet is quite safe. Vesta, designated for Vesta because it was the fourth asteroid discovered, is the second largest one after Ceres, which has a diameter of 525 kilometers. That Ceres, I love Ceres. It was discovered in 1807 and the name for the goddess of the home of the hearth of the Roman mythology. Vesta has a bright surface compared to many other asteroids, making it the only one that occasionally visible to naked eye. When close to the Earth at opposition, it ranges from 5.3 to a faint 6.6 magnitude. Because magnitude 6 stars are visible to the average person in a dark country sky, Vesta is not difficult to find, even from the outer suburbs when it's shining brightest. Like everything in the sky watching, you just have to know where to look. I've seen Vesta a few times without... That would be interesting. ...aid, and it looks exactly like a faint star. All asteroids look like stars in most telescopes. The reason is they're called asteroids. It means star-like. Wow! Only the largest telescope can clearly make out the shape of the largest asteroids. To see them in their rocky glory, a spaceship is much better. Yeah, or you can use the occultation method and make the entire Earth a camera thing. That's a really great thing. I wish I could explain it. So what happens is they know an asteroid's going between a star. They get thousands of astronomers all over the Earth to time it. Put a star and record the brightness of a star as a function of time. They put that in, and NASA actually gets an Earth-sized photograph of that planet or silhouette. The smaller asteroids begin its journey in a protoplanethood when it grows large enough to collect a critical amount of radioactive debris during formation. This material releases heat that melts the interior, causing heavy metals like irons to sink to the core and lighter rocks to rise to form the mantle crust. Wow. That's just... That amazes me. So the radioactive... At this point, astronomers call the object differentiated, the asteroid's equivalent to getting a high school diploma. Both Earth and Vesta got their kindergarten diplomas about the same time, more than 4 billion years ago, and both celebrated a milestone with the release of vast flows of molten lava on the surface. Wow! Vesta stopped there, but the much bigger Earth had more resources to work with, including plate tectonics, life, both of which continue to rework the surface atmosphere of the planet today. Wow! Vesta's brightness varies depending on the distance to the Sun. When it's close to the Earth, it's quite easy to see in binoculars, even with moderately light-polluted sites, and visible with naked eye in rural skies. But trying to find it first with binoculars, then see it, you can spot it with your eyes alone. Like a planet, Vesta orbits the Sun and inches across the sky night to night. If you spot it one night, you'll be able to see it move as you return a couple of nights later. Get to know Vesta. I promise the asteroid won't crash into your party anytime soon. That's really worthwhile seeing it. Again, that would be Vesta. That would be really interesting. Now, zodiacal light. Now, what we're up to? Only 40 minutes. Zodiacal light. I love this zodiacal light. It's just such an awesome thing. Number 28, zodiacal light. Just go through what I've done. It's the iridium flare, Vesta, zodiacal light. Spring feels good after winter. The air softens, the sun sets later. At least in my neighbourhood, the frogs return to sing lusty songs all night long. Evenings from late February to early May, when the moon's not out, sky watchers can see one of the largest yet subtlest sights in the solar system, zodiac light. And look, can I say, there's been a few times out in the deserts of South Australia, would have been with people at night, sort of night patrol. That's the only time you walk at night, I think, in if you don't know where you're going, it's with army patrols. But there's just something awesome about the silhouette of people against zodiac light. I just can't quite describe it. It's beautiful. Let's find out what it is. The name, sky watchers can see one of the largest, subtlest sights in the solar system, the zodiac light. The name hints at where we might look to see it, along the ecliptic highway travelled by the sun, the moon and other planets. In early spring, the invisible highway is pitched at a steep angle to the western horizon. As twilight melts into night, the stars begin to show. Look for a fat finger of softly glowing light tilted on its side in the western sky, pointing towards the Pleiades star cluster. It runs straight up the ecliptic. So occasionally you'll see bright planets like Venus shining there. To the uninitiated, it strongly resembles yet another dome of light pollution in a nearby city. Can I say, it's just glorious. A tapering tapering shape and tilt set it apart. Yeah, that's right. So your light pollution always goes up the horizon. This is an angle. What you're seeing is part of a vast cloud of fine dust left by passing comets and crashing asteroids aglow within the planet of the solar system. The mass of it extends from the sun to at least Jupiter. At the same way, the sun turns your breath into a brilliant cloud of vapour on a cold winter day. Sunlight, backscattered by interplanetary dust, lights up the zodiacal light. I just love the way he grew on your astrobomb. The bottom of the zodiacal light cone is both broader and brighter because it's closer to the sun and reflects sunlight more strongly. As you look up along the cone, your gaze takes you to further from the sun, the light source, and the dust dims and fades, merging into the background, usually. Under pristine skies, the cone tapers into an ultra-faint sash about 5 degrees wide, three fingers held horizontally at arm's length, called the zodiacal band, that circles around the sky. You're blessed with some of the darkest skies on the planet. I've never seen a full band, but stubs sticking out from the zodiacal thumb are visible on good nights. Zodiacal light resembles the Milky Way in the smoky appearance of the brightness. Dark skies are necessary for good view. Just as you make the trip to the countryside for a good look at the Milky Way, you'll want to do the same for zodiacal light. Plan well, as this unique phenomenon has about 2 viewing seasons from the mid-northern latitude observers. Late dusk in the western sky, from mid-February to early May, and again from mid-September through to November on the eastern sky before dawn. During these times, the ecliptic is most nearly vertical to the horizon, so the cone of light stands on its head and shoulders above the horizon haze. At other times of the year, the ecliptic meets the horizon at a shallow angle, and the zodiac light lays flat and low, bending and blending with the horizon glow. I just think that might be due to where he is on the equator. I think say if you're in the north or south pole, further you're up, the more this occurs, is my view. Much of the dust eventually spirals into the sun and gets replenished by new comets over the time. The simple fact that we can still see zodiacal light demonstrates millions of comets have been coming from the farthest reaches of the solar system for brief visits into its warmer since the planets and sun formed 4.5 billion years ago. One additional curiosity, while the zodiac light looks atmospheric, it's most frequently not, definitely not. If you were to remove the Earth's atmosphere, you would still stand, it would still stand tall if you were looking for the literal sands of time, that is. Okay. Now, double stars, and let's read it. We're only 20 minutes in, so 29. Best double stars, of course, Alpha Centauri is the best one I can see. These are all northern hemisphere ones. There are so many double stars in the night sky, it's surprising the sun isn't one. In fact, there's more double stars than little. More than half the stars are born in pairs or multiples and live their lives with one or more companion. Double stars orbit around the common center of gravity. When each star is of similar size, the point is midway between them. When one is much more massive than the other, the partners call the secondary orbits about the other primary star. Double stars are scattered like jewels across the entire sky, with hundreds visible in small telescopes. If you were moved by the sight of binary stars, Tatoo 1 and Tatoo 2, or Luke Skywalker's at Tatooine, the first Star Wars movie, wait until you see the real thing. When looking at double stars through the telescope, and images of science fiction can help us picture what it might be like to see them up close. I've heard telescopes sometimes referring to star splitters because they can divide stars that appear to the single eye as two. With our acts of finely ground glass, let's take a look at several of the brightest, the most colourful and charming double stars across the seasons. All the stars we'll visit are true doubles, where each sun revolves around the other. Okay.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.